The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order State and Local Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections. The first bill up is House File 2552. Representative Simon, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I'll move that House File 2552 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register.
All right, members, this bill is going to the General Register. So if it's going to be placed on the floor, the chair's wish is to have it in the best possible shape it can be in so that we don't have to redo this on the House floor. And I hope, even though we don't have all of our members here, that is understood. Representative Simon, two-year bill, or I believe you do have an amendment that basically puts it in the form that you wish.
Correct. That's correct. So, Mr. Chair, I'll move the DE1 amendment to start out with.
All right. Representative Simon, All right, we do have a quorum. So Representative Simon moves the DE1 amendment. And Representative Simon, why don't you just quickly walk us through that amendment so you can tell us what it does.
Sure. Just by way of background, though, Mr. Chair, I think everyone realizes this is the August primary bill. And the reason we're discussing it now and the reason we're discussing it this early is because this move is essentially mandated by the federal government's passage this fall of the so-called MOVE Act on the federal level, which basically says, the bottom line is, that all states need to have a 45-day absentee ballot period, both before the general election and this is the critical part, before the primary election as well. So that means there needs to be 45 days before each election contest. And right now, with our late primary, which is tied for second latest in the nation, we can't do that, practically speaking. We can't have a 45-day absentee ballot period. I think people here are familiar with the arguments, familiar with what the federal government has done. So now it's just a question of how we effectuate that and implement it. So, Mr. Chair, as you asked, let me go through the DE amendment to make clear what it does. And what I'd like to do is just talk about it in terms of kind of the clusters, the main things it does. First, obviously, it changes the date of the primary. And that you can see in sections 21, 31, and 37. So that's the first and most obvious thing that it does. In 21, 31, and 37, changes the actual date of the primary from the second Tuesday in September to the second Tuesday in August. And I think you should have a handout in your packets that demonstrates what the new dates would look like as opposed to current or the old dates. So for this coming year in 2010, instead of a primary on September 14th, we'd have a primary on September 10th. So that's the first thing the bill does via those three sections. The second thing that the bill, when I speak of the bill, I'm talking about the DE amendment, does is it changes the time related to state campaign finances. That's sections 1 and section 4. Sections 1 and 4 do that. And these are date changes which make sense because they're pegged to the date of the primary, so we've got to change those dates. They're things like when you get your money from the state. And that's an obvious and natural change. The third thing that the bill does is it changes the filing periods, the notice of the filing periods, and the deadline for nominating presidential electors. Those are kind of grouped together. And those, as your summary points out, I'm sure, are in sections 13, 17, 33, 39, 43, 46, and 49. Does that cluster of things. I'll repeat it. Changes the filing period, the notice of the filing period, the deadlines for nominating of presidential electors. And again, those are dates that need to be changed because we're changing the primary, and those dates are typically pegged to the primary. The fourth thing that this does is it changes the timing for establishing polling places, precinct boundaries, receiving lists of potential election judges, and preparing other election materials. Those are sections 14, 15, 16, 20, 22, 44, 45, 48, and 50. I'll repeat that. Changing the timing for establishing polling places, precinct boundaries, receiving lists of potential election judges, and preparing other election materials. Once again, these are examples of dates that need to be changed because things are pegged to various election dates, including the primary. Next, number five on my list, is this bill changes the timing for preparing absentee and mail balloting materials and making them available to voters. Again, kind of clustered with the other stuff. These are dates that need to change. That's sections 5, 6, 17, 18, and 19. Sixth, this bill would allow absentee ballot boards to process military and overseas ballots during the entire absentee balloting period. That's section 12. Seventh, it changes the timing for local jurisdictions to decide whether to hold a primary and to provide notices of elections and of cancellations. That comprises quite a few sections here, and again, these are just date changes that are consistent with what we're going to be doing. That's sections 32, 34, 35, 36, 38, and 40 through 42 does those things. I'll repeat that. It's changing the timing for local jurisdictions to decide whether to hold a primary and to provide notices of elections and of cancellations. Eighth, there are 10 on this list, eighth thing that it does is it clarifies and concerns, and conforms our procedures regarding electronic transmissions of ballots for UOCAVA voters. You may recall that a year or two ago, I think Representative Kalin was involved in this, this is something we've already done, we've allowed that for certain military personnel and others, we can transmit the ballot to them electronically. We already do that. We just need to conform what we're already doing and have already done to make sure we're consistent with the federal law, and that's sections 10 and 11. Ninth is we do some changes to special elections for U.S. Senate. The first of it's sections 25 through 29, and that's in the case of a death or resignation or otherwise a vacancy for a sitting U.S. senator. We just need to make some changes to conform there and to give our local elected officials a little bit more time, the time that they've already been used to under the present regime. And then finally, and I suspect we're going to have a full discussion on this, number 10 of 10, is this changes some of the rules with respect to special elections in the U.S. House. I can explain that a little bit later if you'd like, Mr. Chair. Maybe after the testifiers, I think we'll have a good discussion.
Representative Simon, you also have an amendment to the delete
yes.
everything, and I think we should probably do the amendment to the delete everything
okay.
and then put the delete everything in.
Sure.
And then we can move from there. So Representative Simon.
Well, with that, Mr. Chair, I move as an amendment to the DE amendment, the A1, let's call it the amendment to the amendment.
And Representative Simon, that's on page 13, line 17?
Page 13, line 17. You should have it in your packets, members.
And what exactly, why are we doing this?
Well, we're doing this because I guess there was an oversight in the drafting originally that didn't account for a certain aspect of the date change. So this makes clear that, that's right. Let's see here. Second Tuesday in August of the general election. So, if I could call on Beth Fraser, the Secretary of State's office, this was something that she had discovered.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And the A1 amendment has to do with the changes to filling vacancies in the U.S. House. And it basically says if the governor chooses to hold a special election in the odd year on the date of the November general election, so when some cities and school boards are having their general election, that in that case the primary would be held on the day of the regular primary in August. Right now, with the way the bill is structured, it would be 11 weeks before the day, which would be 1 week after the primary. So there would be a primary for city and school offices, for example, on August 10th, and then a primary for U.S. House on August 17th, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So it's just saying in that case, the primaries would be held together.
All right. Further discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Then to the delete everything amendment. We should put the bill in order. Representative Simon has moved what is now an amendment, an amended delete everything. So all those in favor of Representative Simon's motion on the delete everything signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
Nope.
Motion prevails. The bill is now in the order that the sponsor wishes. So discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might suggest, we have a testifier or two here who might want to testify in favor of the bill, and I thought maybe it would be good for them to just testify broadly, and then we can get into some of the page and line discussion, if that's okay.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Bob Carey. I'm the director of the Federal Voting Assistance Program, otherwise known as FVAP. As you get more involved in this issue, you'll find out that this whole military and overseas voting issue has more acronyms than probably any other aspect of government. I've tried to see if I could ever actually do a complete sentence with nothing but acronyms, but at this point I've had to use participles and gerunds, but we'll see if I can get there at some point today. Before I became director of the Federal Voting Assistance Program, I was executive director of a group called the National Defense Committee, which is a grassroots military service organization that did a lot of work on military voting rights. First time I ever went into a polling place to vote in person was when I turned 40. I've been in the Navy for a number of years. I was also an overseas civilian voter, and I've experienced firsthand these problems. In October of 2004, I was a reservist, and I was mobilized. And I was mobilized about 3 weeks before the election. Too late for me to be able to get my absentee ballot. Same thing happened to me on the backside, and I was coming back in 2005. I got extended too close to the November 2005 mayoral election in New York City, where I was a resident at the time, and was unable to get an absentee ballot at that point. That got me thinking that there had to be a better way in order to be able to make a situation like this work, and I started to get involved in the issue. 2 years later, I find myself in charge of the program of the federal government that's responsible for this. Now, the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act that was enacted in law October 28th of last year was put in place largely because the military and the overseas voter experience much more difficulty than the average voter does in exercising their right to vote. Specifically, in 2008, whereas 91% of all absentee ballots were returned in the general electorate, only 72% of Minnesota military and overseas absentee ballots were returned. Now Minnesota is doing far better than the rest of the country. Nationally, the average is only about 63% were returned. And that was in large part due to a number of changes that you all implemented last year, and also the aggressive program of the Secretary of State's office in order to be able to make sure that these ballots were counted as much as possible. But more still needs to be done. And that's what the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act try to do. The mandate of 45 days prior is in large part because the very nature of military ballot delivery is that it's going to take at least 30 days each way for people in Iraq or Afghanistan or ships at sea. Under the best of circumstances, these folks may, hopefully be able to get their ballots within 45 days, get it out to them and give them time to be able to vote it and get it back. Because when we look at where the voting failure lies, when you look at the military and overseas voter and where they experience their greatest failure, they experience greater voting failure in registration and in ballot transmission and in ballots being cast but not counted than they then do their general electorate counterparts. But where 81% of the failure, over almost 400,000 military and overseas absentee voters failed in being able to vote, was in their ballot being transmitted and not returned. And that's because there's just not enough time. And that was the main reason for expanding and federally mandating the amount of time available to 45 days. In the 2008 election, when I was director of the National Defense Committee, I wrote an article basically comparing the success that Minnesota had versus the failure, the abject failure that New York had. And some of the things that Minnesota has done in the past have really helped, such as emailing out blank ballots, using the federal write an absentee ballot universally, and removing the witness requirement. I mean, those were great. But the fundamental issue, the number one issue for military and overseas voters, is having enough time for their ballot to get out to them so that they can vote it and return it. Because at some point, physics takes hold. I mean, stuff can only move so fast. And at some point, you have a competition between ballots being delivered to military service members and other supplies. I mean, the military postal system is very well defined, let's say going to Kuwait or going to Tokyo or going to Germany. And you can get a letter over to them in 6-7 days. But it's that last mile that's really difficult. That combat outpost, that forward operating base, that ship at sea, that makes it very much much more difficult. So you'll have an average delivery time of mail to ships at sea of 20-30 days. And if you don't have that 45-day window, you're basically ensuring that many military voters are not going to be able to get their ballot in time to be able to return it. When you looked at where Minnesota voters experienced their greatest failure, more than 30% of the failure that Minnesota, the ballots that were rejected in Minnesota from military and overseas voters were because they arrived after the election day, after the due date. And, that just, for a military voter, that can just be very, very frustrating, especially when you've taken an oath to defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States and then to be systematically prevented from exercising the most fundamental constitutional rights. And so the I know that a lot of people have discussed the provisions of the MOVE Act that allow for a waiver. But, one, the waiver is not perpetual. A waiver has to be submitted to the Department of Defense each and every election. And each and every election, the Department of Defense has to analyze that waiver request in terms of, the specifics of that election. And it's still the waiver request still has to show that the state has a plan to provide adequate time for the voter to be able to receive, vote, and return their ballot. And that's going to be, the military postal system data we have right now would say 60 days is the minimum time necessary. So, so to the extent that people may be sort of use a crafts term, betting on the come, they're going to be able to get a waiver, is by no means guaranteed. And if the waiver is not granted, then DOJ will exercise their independent enforcement authority. Department of Justice will exercise their independent enforcement authority to determine whether or not they need to seek injunctive relief with the in federal court. So that was the biggest thing that I just wanted to get across, is that I wanted to emphasize that for many of these military voters and for these overseas civilian voters, who oftentimes are not just expatriates, but are foreign service officers in the U.S. State Department, Peace Corps workers, missionaries, U.S. contractors. I mean, there's probably 150,000 U.S. citizen contractors overseas right now working for the federal government in a contracting role. When I was deployed overseas, The armory officer that was issuing my weapons and issuing my flak jacket and issuing me my helmet was a contractor and did not have the same voting rights that I did, even though he got subjected to the same mortar shells that I did. And if we're going to be able to provide them something of an opportunity, we have to provide a minimum number of days. I think I covered the main points. I'd be more than happy to answer any of the questions you have now or later on. Thank you very much, sir.
Kerry, thank you. You may want to stay just for a little bit. There may be questions depending on what happens in the next 45 minutes. Yes, Representative Simon, who else do you have?
Mr. Chair, I think there may be one or more folks from local units of government who want to testify.
All right. Let's see who's coming. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Ferber. I'm the city clerk at the city of Bloomington. I'm here today representing the League of Minnesota Cities and the Minnesota Municipal Clerks Association Task Force on Elections. And I'm here to speak in support of the bill. Mr. Kerry made a very compelling argument, obviously, for our military and overseas voters to have this increased opportunity to have their ballot counted. From an administrative perspective, it breaks our hearts when we get absentee ballots coming in after an election, particularly if it's from military and overseas voters who have made that effort to get the ballot there, but because of the timing, the ballot arrives after election day and can't be counted. So we're here today to urge you to support this bill, and also the timing of this bill obviously is crucial to us in 2010. As our election season is coming up quickly, and there's lots of work to be done to notify our polling places, our election judges, candidates, because of everything moving back into August, time frames are going to be different this year, and so we urge you to take quick action on this bill and support it. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Lennon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ferber, one of the questions that occurs to me as I look at this has to do with the amount of time that local units of government have to change boundaries. And I guess my question for you is, by moving that boundary change up from June 1 to May 1, what kind of bind is that putting local officials in terms of having the information you need from the Census Bureau to make the changes in boundaries?
Mr. Ferber?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the if I recall right, the bill changes the boundary change deadline from June, the current June 1st to May 1st. Is that correct?
Yes, that's
Representative
correct.
Representative Lang.
Yeah. And I believe that the census, which will be done this year, and redistricting will come after this. So I, from the perspective of administration of elections this year, the only changes that are going to be made are precinct change, boundary changes that may be made by cities and municipalities. And I don't believe it's going to be a hardship at all this year. Most of them have been set for the last 10 years since the last census, and the only changes usually are splitting them because of population change during the time frame here. But most of them, I think you would find, and you would probably check with the Secretary of State's office, but I think that generally there's be very few changes during this time frame.
Representative Simon's got a something to add here.
Mr. Chair, I've just been informed that we're in a statutory blackout period for line changes right now because the census has started. So it won't be until after redistricting anyway that any city will be able to do that. And that's under current law.
Representative Lanning?
Well, kind of as a follow-up to that, when then are local units of government going to be given the information they need to change the boundaries? And how does that date relate to the May 1 requirement in this bill?
Representative Simon, our Secretary of State's office.
Well,
Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, I don't know if you're talking about a census issue, basically. When are they going to get the census data, or is it something else?
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, yes. When are local units of government going to get the information they need to change the boundaries, and how does that relate to the new requirement for the time by which they have to change the boundaries?
Representative Lanning, I think Mr. Mansky has come down to assist in this, so welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Joe Mansky from Ramsey County, and Representative Lanning, to answer your question directly, in a statute that's not being amended by this bill, there is a requirement for the legislature to finish redistricting 25 weeks before the state primary. So as a consequence of moving the state primary up, the date on which redistricting must end will also move up by about a month, and so it will accommodate the earlier date by which all the cities are required to set their new precinct boundaries.
Representative Lang.
Thank you. Well, thank you for that explanation. I guess my follow-up question would be, does that create any problems? The fact that it's in statute now and it will automatically change, does that create any problems in terms of following this new provision?
Mansky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, the main problem is actually the legislature not doing the redistricting in the year ending in 1. If they do that, that solves a lot of problems. But since it's likely that it will go over to the year ending in 2, we're ready to accommodate that schedule because that's what we've been using the last 2 times out. It's not an ideal world, but, it's the world we're in.
Thank you.
Representative Simon, I requested that the governor's office be here to testify on your bill. There have been comments publicly from the governor's office about this bill. I'm not going to characterize those comments, but is there anyone from the governor's office that is here today to testify on the bill? I don't see any. Representative Simon, do you wish to characterize the governor's position on the bill?
Mr. Chair, that's somewhat tricky. Brian McClung said the other day, his quote, which is for attribution in the media, is that the governor supports moving the primary earlier. As to this particular bill, I can't say that there's a position one way or another. I would characterize it as being generally supportive, but as with a lot of legislation, the governor, for whatever reason, doesn't want to commit right now, apparently.
Further questions? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in general, I also do support moving the primary to the second Tuesday in August, have for a long time. And so in general, that I think the question that I have more is some of the issues that are within the bill, and Representative Simon and I have discussed some of those things. So I think in general, I think the position might be it depends upon some of the extraneous issues that are in this bill. More of a strict conformity would be the intention that I think the governor would be more comfortable with. And so some of these matters, I think if we can deal with some of these, I think that would give a greater comfort to all of us. And Representative Simon and I have discussed that, and I do have an amendment to bring forward those as well.
Representative Kiffmeyer, are you bringing that amendment forward at this time?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon and I have discussed this, and so I've just deferred to his bringing forward some of these things as well.
Well, members,
but I would prefer to have it distributed.
I had made a statement that if we are going to amend this bill, we're going to do it here, and hopefully not on the House floor. And I'd like to do it here so there's public testimony on these amendments and discussion, rather than just bullet point political points being made on the House floor, where we really don't know what we're doing and may do something that is either intentionally good or unintentionally very bad. So if we're going to amend, I would hope we'd bring the amendments forward in committee. Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I did see a few minutes before the hearing a copy of Representative Kiffmeyer's amendment. We did speak yesterday by phone last night about some of her concerns, and I'm willing to accommodate at least a few of those concerns right now without the need for her full amendment. I could explain if that's
all right.
Okay.
Representative Simon.
And I agree we should be doing all of our amendment work on this bill in particular here, and I think we can do that today. First of all, Representative Kiffmeyer, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think one of the concerns that you had was on Section 7 of the bill, that it wasn't really necessary to the subject of this bill. It has to do with a period that we in the legislature changed from 10 to 20 days a while ago, and now we'd be changing from 20 to 30 days. That's something that need not be part of this bill. So I would be willing, Mr. Chair, to orally amend the bill to delete Section 7 from the bill.
Representative Simon, is that a motion to delete
Section 7? That's a motion to delete Section 7.
The motion before the committee is on page 4, Section 7, which would be lines 4.2 to 4.24. Representative Simon is moving to delete. So, to that motion, discussion. Representative Kiffmeyer?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer, do you wish to speak to that amendment?
I support the deletion of page 4, Section 7.
Discussion. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another concern that was raised was in Section 16 on page 8. This has to do with when, that's right, this is when the lists are forwarded of eligible voters to act as election judges. The bill would change it from June 1st to 2 weeks after precinct caucuses. There would, of course, at the end of the bill, there's an exception for this year. It wouldn't take effect until 2012. Representative Kiffmeyer was concerned about that. She thought that was quite a bit early. So I think something we had talked about is, and I should mention that this is from some of the local election administrators who wanted an earlier date, but perhaps it is a little bit too early. So what I'd like to do, and Representative Kiffmeyer, tell me if this is okay, is go to May 1st. They do want earlier. You had thought that 2 weeks after caucuses was a little too early. So what I'm proposing, Mr. Chair, is specifically on line 8.25, strike the changes or get rid of the changes. In other words, the strikeout language and the underline language. And then instead of on June 1st, substitute on May 1st.
Representative Simon, I'm going to let Mr. Gehring put that in order, and then he'll read back the amendment so it's clear to everyone what we're doing here. So we'll take it just a minute to make sure that
Mr. Chair,
exactly what you wanted.
Yeah, and I should just point out, too, that the same change would be made on line 8.31.
Yes. Okay. All right. Mr. Gehring, you want to?
Mr. Chair, I believe the A2 amendment, you could split the amendment and take the pieces that make that change as written correctly on lines 1.4 to 1.7 on the A2 amendment, would change the dates to May 1st and May 15th.
I don't have it. Representative Simon, we have before us the A2 amendment. I assume that's Representative Kiffmeyer's or one of Representative Kiffmeyer's amendment.
Mr. Chairman, that is my amendment. I apologize. I did sign this one, but I forgot to give you the one that had my signature on it, Mr. Gehring. So, yes, it is.
Right. If everyone has the A2 amendment, Mr. Gehring is going to explain how we could do this. And I think the best way to do it would be, Rep. Simonson, why don't you withdraw your oral amendment?
I'll withdraw it.
And then we'll work off the A2 amendment so that we have in front of us proper language, and we'll let Mr. Gehring work from the A2 amendment. So I'm going to let Mr. Gehring, why don't you, off the A2 amendment, tell us what we can do to accommodate Rep. Simon and Rep. Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, on the A2 amendment, the amendment that Rep. Simon and Rep. Kiffmeyer are offering would be lines 1.4 through 1.7 of the A2 amendment, that language there, and then also on page 21, delete section 50, which you can see at the bottom on line 1.22.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
I would just add to that, if I could, Mr. Gehring, that I would personally be willing to take 1.22 through the end, through 1.26. I think we'd have to make that conforming change, too, that the whole act is effective after a final act.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. So you'd be amending into the bill lines 1.4 to 1.7 of the A2 amendment, and then also lines 1.22 to 1.24 of the A2 amendment.
Members, is everyone clear on what we're doing? All right. And that is Representative Simon's motion. So any discussion to that motion? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to election judges in particular, precinct caucuses are throughout the state, many, many thousands of precincts that go on and collect this election judge data. To expect them to do it 2 weeks after precinct caucuses is totally unrealistic to the people. And I think whenever you get something like this that is coming from the grassroots, from the people, we need to give them time. And I appreciate the election administrators. Certainly the time and some of those issues sensitive to, but I think in this case we really want to make sure that we give the people the time, and by making this amendment we do give them that fair amount of time to get their work done, and also includes moving up the date for the benefit of the election administrators. So I support this amendment.
All right. Further discussion to the amendment? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick confirmation question for Mr. Mansky. Section 16 would now be effective this year with the May 1st and May 15th deadlines, and your office specifically, as well as what you hear from around the state, you would be comfortable with that being effective this year?
Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, to be honest, we would prefer a little earlier, but Representative Kiffmeyer is not wrong. There, we do need to give the party some time to digest the caucus lists and so on, because we want to make sure we get as good a list as we can from the parties. So, we can live with May 1st. That's not a problem.
And Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mansky, and you can live with May 1st, 2010 as this year's deadline?
Mr. Mansky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, yes, we can.
Great. Thank you.
Did the Secretary of State's office wish to comment on this? No. All right. Further discussion? Representative Lanning.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. I'm unclear. Did the First Amendment that was approved by Representative Simon, line 1.3, is that, when he withdrew his amendment, was that the amendment he withdrew?
Representative Lanning, he withdrew what was an oral amendment, and there was some confusion once that amendment had been put out, and then we saw this amendment that was much clearer. He withdrew what was his oral amendment, and we're working off the A2.
Same.
That's the one he withdrew.
And so, Mr. Chairman, that Section 7 has been deleted then as
yes.
part of what the record.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Further discussion to the A2 amendment that's been as divided. The A2 amendment as divided. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other deletion here. In talking with Representative Kiffmeyer, would be Section 29 on page 13. I agree with her that although it may be something worth doing, apparently it's just eliminating some redundant language as to what is marked on the ballot. It's not necessarily something we need, and so I would move, Mr. Chair, that we delete Section 29 starting on page 13.3.
All right. Motion before the committee. Discussion to that motion. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was one portion that I'd like to talk about now that Representative Kiffmeyer had, I think, some issues with, and that was Section 44, beginning on page 18 and going over to page 19. The operative language is actually on the top of page 19, the actual change. And to talk about why, what this is and why we do need this in here to conform to the federal law, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Fraser, if I could.
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This section relates to candidates' names being rotated on in particular the primary ballot. And the statute requires that names be rotated so that approximately the same number of voters see your name at the top of the list, in the middle of the list, and the bottom of the list. And we make those rotations based upon the number of registered voters on a date certain. And right now, that date certain is set in the rules and is June 1st. And what we've heard from the ballot vendors who do the programming, which leads to the rotation, is that right now, June 1st in 2010, for example, is the last day of the filing period. That means that they can't begin doing their programming until then, until they know the numbers of registered voters. Moving that date up to May 1st allows them to begin their programming so that once the filing is done, they can just plop in the candidate names as opposed to having to wait. So that's why this is looks like new law. It's actually superseding rules, and why it is related to the preparation of ballots, and otherwise, without this language, would delay the preparation of ballots.
Discussion. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Simon, I believe that discussion eliminates my concern, and that it would be okay to leave Section 44 as written.
Then, Representative Simon, do you have any other points about the bill as amended?
I do.
All right, Representative Simon.
And one that I think we need to have a discussion about here today that Representative Kiffmeyer and others have brought to my attention that they'd like to have a discussion on. And that has to do with the changes, and I think, by the way, Representative Kiffmeyer, this covers what I'm about to say will then cover all that you had in your amendment. I believe that's true. So I think we're down to our remaining issues, or is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon.
Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. I believe so. I'm just going to check off the list here and make sure, but I think the best use of our time now is this big part.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're talking about special elections for U.S. House, not Senate, but for House. And there are some provisions in here, particularly sections 23, 24, and 30, which pertain to that. And what this does, members, is it sets up kind of a three-tiered timing system for U.S. House special elections. I know that seems new and it seems complicated, but there are reasons for it, which I think we should discuss here today, because I know Representative Kiffmeyer had a concern about it. The reason, basically, and I'll leave it to others who are immersed in this to talk about it, the reason is that if we don't do this, given the fact that we have now a 45-day absentee ballot period before every general election, a 45-day absentee ballot period before every regular primary election, in the case of special elections, you have the real risk of having overlapping 45-day periods. So, for example, take this year. The primary is August 10th, so you go back 45 days from August 10th, and that's the beginning of the absentee ballot period. That's what the feds have told us we have to do. Now let's say a governor in the future sets a special election date so that the absentee ballot period for that special election general, not to mention the special election primary, might kind of intersect with the other absentee ballot period. So you might have things all over the map. You might have a special primary ballot period that ends on this day, a special general absentee ballot period on this day, then you've got the regular primary that's on this day, and then you've got the general election on this day. And so this just divides things up into thirds. And make sure that we can be as consistent as possible. So for ease of administration, the local folks, we don't have all these intersecting and overlapping absentee ballot periods. I know it's a lot of words to say that in here, but maybe others can speak to why we need that formulation.
Mr. Mansky?
Mr. Chairman, again, I think Representative Simon did a fairly good job of explaining what's going on, and actually, even though there are a lot of new words here, it essentially preserves the system that we have now, where most vacancies in the legislature tend to occur December, January, as members get elected to different offices and vacate, or they get appointed by the governor as to various positions, in which case our only real interest is to get the special election over before we start working on the state elections for the year. The second scenario is where the vacancy occurs during the middle of the year, in which case, and I think this is kind of a long-standing policy for all of us, and I think of this body as well, is to have as few discrete election days as possible, and to the extent that that is possible, we like to have a special election on the day of a regularly scheduled election, and that would be, in this case, the state primary. And then the third scenario, which is largely unchanged from the current law, is that when the vacancy occurs very close to the general election, and in this scenario after the filing period has ended, there is no special election. That vacancy would just remain until the general election, until somebody was elected. And for those of you who recall, when Representative Vento passed away, that was the situation there. His vacancy occurred within 150 days of the general election, and as a result, his term was just vacated for the rest of the year.
Any further discussion on these sections? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, I guess the obvious question then is why two sets of rules for vacancies in elective office? Why are we making the change at the federal level and yet not making the same conforming changes here in the state legislature?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, I think that's a good question. I guess that's really because there exist right now two separate statutes on the subject. I mean, we've already in the body of the bill amended things so that we don't have these problems for state elections, but there is already in statute, as you can see, special language and a special statute for special U.S. Senate elections and then a special one for special U.S. House elections. So that's just a function of the fact that once upon a time someone decided to put it in a separate section of statute.
Further discussion? There's no motion before the committee on this. We're just discussing these. So, Representative Kiffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the explanation, but there are two things. One is, what is necessary for conformity to federal law? And I know that we do have maybe some questions or concerns or so on, but it seems as though some of these things could be dealt with in an administrative bill. Deal with some of those things. So why is this, and maybe you can give me some more comfort to say, why is it necessary to make these changes in this particular bill? Because one of the focuses is conformity to the federal law, not turning it into a great big administration bill that we kind of throw extras in as long as we're doing it. That's a concern and it's a problem. So how is this necessary for conformity?
Representative Simon, you wish to respond to that?
Let me take a first crack at it, Mr. Right. Chair. I think that you're right, Representative Kiffmeyer, we should tailor this as narrowly as we can and not throw a bunch of other stuff in it. But there's some dates and date changes and other things that seem to follow naturally. Are they compelled by federal law? No. I'll give one example that all of us can relate to. One of the sections that thankfully was not controversial in here was changing the lawn sign date, which now is August 1st. Well, if we have a primary on August 10th, it makes sense that candidates who have a contested primary should have more than 9 days to have their lawn signs out. Now, that's not compelled by the federal government, but it's in this bill. It just is something that makes sense to do. And I would put this personally under that same category. Does the federal government compel us to do this? No. But for ease of administration, now that we know we have to do a bunch of other stuff, it probably makes sense to people like Mr. Mansky and others that they don't have these intersecting absentee ballot periods. That's all. So I'm not going to claim that it's compelled by the federal law. It's not. But it seems to me to make sense to do.
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think that what's compelled by the federal law is to provide a 45-day absentee ballot period for special federal elections. And so to implement that, so then the question is, how does the state implement that? And I think it's nearly impossible logistically to have a special election for U.S. House during the absentee ballot period for the state primary or for the state general election. And so without this tiered approach, it could mean that if there's a vacancy, that there would be a special primary election or a special general election for a U.S. House seat on August 1st, and then a state primary on August 10th, which means that the local election officials have to deal with, and the voters have to deal with, two separate absentee ballots, voters coming in, okay, now which election did you want to vote in? Okay, let me be sure I get you the right ballot. Let's be sure we keep these ballots separate. It also means that they need to deploy and then test and reprogram all of the election equipment in that example within 9 days, which is a very short period of time, to ensure that all of the equipment is has been changed from one election to another election. I think that saying if a vacancy occurs close enough to the state primary, that we'll just hold it as part of the state primary, and if it occurs after that period, that we're going to elect a congressperson in November anyway, let's just seat that person early, is what makes sense. You're right that to comply with federal law, we don't need to do that, but I don't think it makes sense to just pass a law that substitutes 45 days for each of these elections, but then isn't workable.
Representative Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, I would definitely agree that some of these things may make sense. I just think I want to make the point that what's necessary, conformity, and what is good administration, it wasn't a matter of objecting to some of these things being done. It was a matter of done in this bill, when this bill has been portrayed to be, to the governor as well and to all of us, as a conformity bill. So I just wanted to be sure that we've tried to certainly be accommodating in regards to some of those things that do push the bounds a little bit beyond strict conformity, and do try and include some of that. And so we've worked to be accommodating to that, and certainly understanding of that. On the other hand, it's not the last election bill that we can deal with these matters sometimes. So I think it was more a matter of giving an alternative through this language that did deal with the conformity. But the certainly the election administrators and those overlapping, we've dealt with that for years. And in particular, it happens with school district elections, where you'll have them in the midst of primary, general, all kinds of time, over holidays and all kinds of things. And I think the concept is making sure that we don't do that, but I'd like to see that we don't do it with anything, not just for this particular case. I think we should have a situation where our people aren't wearied out by all these different notices and elections, polling places changing. There are many times you'll have a school district election, and it'll be a combined polling place, and this will happen in between a primary and a general, or after, 2 weeks after a general, and people's polling places will change. And so I'm very sympathetic to the kinds of things that you're bringing up, very much so. But I think my approach would be to say, not only is it good for this, but it's good for a lot of other parts of the election system as well. We ought to take a look at that and apply that concept and the simplicity of that, and consideration for the voters as well as the election administrators, and take a look at doing something about those other areas as well, not so much that I have an objection about this particular application. So strict conformity, and I would look to do something that might include more than just the special elections. But having said that, I appreciate your explanation.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, and to the Secretary of State's office, I guess one of the things that would be very helpful, and the chairman knows this as an educator, a lot of people are audio learners, but even more are visual learners. And so I think one of the things that would be very helpful as this bill moves forward is to create a timeline to show what the necessary conforming changes in and of itself does, and then what the discretionary changes that are in here attempts to clean up. Right, so that overlap, we can get a better idea of what that means and do it in a visual, I think would be incredibly helpful.
Representative Biskins, this bill is going directly to the House floor.
And having that information on the House floor, Mr. Chair, would clear up a lot of confusion.
And I want to make that point that I would prefer we not start cleaning up any bill on the House floor, that it be cleaned up here first. Mr. Carey, did you wish to comment on... I think I see nodding of heads, Representative Biskin, so I assume that that will be taken care of, that clarification. But, Mr. Carey, did you wish to comment?
From an execution point of view, within the military and State Department voting assistance program, having a simultaneous election date is far easier to implement, both from the point of view of getting the word out to the military and overseas voters that an election is actually coming up, and being able to allow the voting assistance officers adequate time to be able to assist the voters. Every single military unit of at least 25 people has a voting assistance officer, so we have over 9,300 military voting assistance officers, and then there's 250 State Department voting assistance officers at every embassy and consulate. So, you know, having that ability to combine, the elections allows us to get the word out more easily to the voters, and probably will have a lot easier aspect for the voter themselves to be able to participate. And then the last thing is that the military postal system is also implementing an expedited return. We're basically going to have all the ballots come back to the military postal system in an express mail manner. It's not an insignificant cost. And so to the extent that ballots can be combined in the same envelope, it will help reduce the cost of implementing a program like that.
Further discussion? Representative Simon, did you have anyone else that wishes to testify on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so, unless there's someone I don't know about.
I don't see anyone else that wishes to come down, so... Final comments to the bill as amended.
Well, members, thanks a lot for your time. I think this has been a good discussion. I want to thank particularly Representative Kiffmeyer, Representative Broad, too, who used to be on this committee, is joining us once again here in the back. And thanks for working with me and alerting me to your concerns. And I think we've been able to accommodate, I think, almost every single one here by amendment. So thanks, members, and we'll discuss this next on the floor. Thanks for your consideration. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 2552, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Members, before you leave, Thursday we are having a hearing, an information hearing, and we don't have many in this committee. This one is going to be on the three recommendations from the three major pension groups on what they are now looking at in the Pension Commission. I would hope all of you will come to the hearing so you fully understand the shared pain proposals that are being discussed in the Pension Commission. When that bill comes back, there will be some controversy about the solutions in the new economy to keeping these pensions stable. So Thursday, I would like to see all of you here so that when the bill comes back from the Pension Commission, you will know what you're voting on. Representative Poppy.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of April 7, 2009.
Any discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. With that, meeting is adjourned.